www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. How are you doing?
Not so bad. You had the plague, Omicron?
No, I've managed to avoid it so far. So fingers crossed, we'll keep going.
Lucky you. Me too as well. I haven't had it. And we're into a new year, of course.
Yep. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you and to everyone listening. And another new year of recordings. And I think slightly mixing things up a little bit, which is where we're going to get to in a minute. Just doing a little bit more outside of our comfort zone, shall we say.
Oh, yeah. I think we've done a lot about storage, but we've also talked quite a lot about cloud. And that's sort of where we're going to spend quite a lot of our time talking about things, I suspect, over the next year, 2 years.
Absolutely. So let's introduce our guest, Aaron Kanner from... You want to tell us the company, Aaron, and you can do a little bit of a background, describe yourself, and tell everybody what you do.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you so much for having me, Chris and Martin. So my name's Aaron. I'm the co-founder and CEO at Archera. We are a FinOps automation platform working across Azure and AWS. And actually, my background is that I was, very early on in the Azure story, an employee over in the Fabric team. So I worked a lot on figuring out when folks wanted a VM in that ecosystem, what box to put it on, what the capacity constraints were, what the margin constraints were of actually renting out these servers on a pay-as-you-go model very early in the cloud journey in the early 2010s. And from there, I actually went and worked in the machine learning space on the infrastructure level at a startup that was acquired by AWS to become their machine learning and AI team. So I was part of the team that launched the SageMaker product, which I think a lot of folks in the cloud ecosystem, particularly the AWS ecosystem, are fairly aware of. They've been pushing that very aggressively. Grew that team from 8 folks to 800 folks, and kind of through that time actually launched a ton of managed services and hardware products in the machine learning space, and really ran headlong into this problem of financial operations married with this cloud computing revolution in some of the most sophisticated technology companies in the world, who are our early customers for the machine learning infrastructure we were putting out in the AWS ecosystem. So folks like Netflix's, the Airbnbs of the world, the Spotify's of the world, who were all coming to us with the problem of, look, we'd love to use your machine learning infrastructure. Our data is resident in AWS, but it's so bloody expensive, and I don't even know what my commodity compute is going to look like tomorrow. So why would I turn on something like a GPU machine with an order of magnitude more cost and an order of magnitude more variance in how it's being used by teams when I can't even predict what's going on, yesterday in many cases because of how bad the visibility tooling is and how complex the pricing models have gotten. So I really kind of ran headlong into this problem in 2017, and looking at the market out here in Seattle where we're based, where a lot of the vendors who were trying to help with this were sort of born, folks like Apptio and Cloudability, I saw this fundamental gap where the operational concerns and kind of the backwards looking fire putting out methodology was something that was constantly being preached by both the vendors and their partners, AWS and partners mm-hmm. like consultants and, folks who come in after the fire is already burned to help put it out. A lot of the tools were based around that sort of backwards looking visibility. But what I started to realize marrying my early days at Azure, where we were working really heavily on trying to predict capacity because that's what moved the needle in terms of the ability to provide cheap, plentiful and available compute to customers, with this idea of as you scale, you get less and less predictability instead of more and more predictability. I wanted to try and flip the paradigm on the head. So I actually teamed up with my brother, who is a sort of technologist, but coming at it from a financial perspective. So he worked at D.E. Shaw and Uber working on pricing algorithms and futures contracts. And we tried to create a different take essentially in this FinOps space, one that's primarily based around predictive modeling and actually using the confidence that helping customers build these predictive models, their cloud usage brings about, to actually offer things like insurance markets and resale markets for capacity on top of those underlying sort of primitives that cloud vendors are offering to their customers around commitments. So that's really the ideation that started the business, and would love to dig more into that.
Perfect. So that gives people, I think, hopefully a great background. So just quickly, Martin, let's just, from your and our perspective, we've talked about the concept of FinOps, and I don't know whether you want to describe what FinOps is, Martin, whether, but I think we talked about on and off quite a lot, and it's an area we keep coming back to, isn't it?
We keep coming back to this. It's basically financial operations behind cloud. I mean, understanding your cloud utilization, your costs, and then optimizing that whole process. I mean, I think the first step for FinOps for most people was actually understanding what they're spending and where it's spending. And then you'll move on to the optimization and working out how is this going to work. It's a really interesting overlap because most IT people, although very mathematical, don't really think about finance. They're not too worried. Developers don't really care. It's not a discipline which a lot of people have got involved in. And it's also one of these things where we're quite used to, it's not, I'm being a bit unfair to IT managers. We are used to cost optimization. We're used to beating vendors up when we got a CapEx purchase. That's a very different case when you're moving into an operational OpEx expenditure world where you've got an ongoing situation, which you're going to have to optimize on a monthly basis.
Absolutely. So, Aaron, where do the customers usually start? I mean, you know, Martin's sort of implying that that seems to be the most obvious thing, really, that if you don't know what you're actually using, you can't work out how you can actually optimize it. So I guess most people expect that the first step they're going to do is try and quantify what they've actually got on the floor.
That's exactly it. And actually, I think that's where, in many ways, the market, when we entered it, was at. It was at the stage where everyone wanted visibility. Everyone wanted help tagging infrastructure, figuring out who's using what, going through all the archaic attribution rules and systems within Amazon or Azure to try and pick that apart. And I think there's a wonderful set of tools to help customers now do that, to get that first step, obviously with varying levels of developer engineering engagement and work required to actually set those initial things up. But I think what we started to understand is, you know, even if everyone knows exactly where each dollar is being spent and can do chargeback and show back to the engineers, what becomes very difficult is actually marrying that with a plan of action. Because the naive thing saying, hey, if this is under provisioned, you know, go to a lower level of box or, you know, turn it off when it's not being used might not make sense in the context of many applications. So having a one size fits all approach for the actual optimization step becomes really difficult. And I think that's where a lot of the gaps start to appear. And what it really requires is actually sitting down between engineering and finance and building things like prioritization and roadmap and financial constraints into a model that's actually shared and can be used to inform those sorts of subsequent decisions. And I think that's the level at which, you know, you see the best teams pull ahead with dedicated heads and resources who do this cross-functional work, and teams who just have the visibility in place sort of fall back into that reactive primarily model where they're not getting the most out of the most leverage, I should say, out of optimizing ongoing expenses in a way that sort of balances the developer time with the financial gain for that specific piece of infrastructure, that product, that project, etc.
Okay, let's come back to that in a second. And I think there's got to be a starting point here. So for instance, if I've got tens of thousands of VMs and I've got all sorts of different resources, I need to, first of all, I surely need a way to tag it to a line of business, to an owner, and so on. So does that end up being manual, or do you, you know, are we now seeing tools to do that sort of technique?
Yeah, I would say that mostly in the 2010s, this is a manual process that engineers had to do by hand on each box they spun up. And in the last 3 to 5 years, tools like Archera and a ton of other tools in the industry like Cloudability, et cetera, have emerged to help folks do this in a more centralized way with things like synthetic tags and automated tagging and right back into the infrastructure. So I think the tooling there has improved significantly. But at the end of the day, it's still very much something where an engineer or a financial or operational person with deep knowledge of the business has to sit down and define these schemas up front. And, you know, with the best tooling, you only have to define the schemas once, and then new infrastructure that's spun up will automatically categorize itself. But using just the native tools from Azure or AWS, this becomes an ongoing responsibility for someone to go and do manually.
I guess, Martin, you know, you could just have an exception process. You see things appear, you've got to find a way of attributing them to somebody as soon as possible. You know, we've done that with CMDBs and all that sort of stuff for decades. It's not like it's a new idea.
Well, yeah, but I think one of the biggest problems most corporates and large organizations have had with cloud, certainly over the early adoption phase, has been the fact that it's very easy for somebody to go and spin stuff up. You just need a credit card. So you've ended up with a fragmented model, fragmented user accounts, customer IDs. And that's what some of the challenges is actually working out what your exposure is, how much are you paying for your cloud? Because you may not actually know, because a lot of the lines of business have gone off and done their own thing. It's one of the beauties for them is they don't actually have to involve a centralized IT function if they don't want to. So they just go off and do things. And that's, I think, that's where the FinOps disciplines really come in, trying to get people to accept getting that centralized view. You found out, Aaron?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this actually speaks to a broader question that constantly comes up when we're talking to customers, which is, hey, we didn't actually adopt the cloud to save money. We adopt the cloud to innovate faster, to build faster, to empower engineers. And it sounds like what FinOps best practices as they live today are saying is we actually have to slow everything down. We have to put in centralized controls. We have to ask permission every time we spin up a box. And I think that's actually a false dichotomy. We hear that. And I think folks who are trying to implement this based on a book like the FinOps book start to really put those processes in place and slow folks down. But I think it's a false dichotomy because of the fact that with the right tooling and with the right processes in place, you can have your cake and eat it too in many respects, right? If the thing is running for an extra day or two without being tagged, that's not a huge issue. And you don't need something that is blocking developers from running that marginal experiment until they get permission. I think there's a way to effectively negotiate that without losing that flexibility of the cloud. And it's really a function of what are the tools in place and then how do you operationalize those best practices in as lightweight a way as possible, while still keeping that sort of centralized record or state such that you can go back and do that attribution retroactively at the end of the month or whenever your reporting period is.
I guess the biggest challenge there is the dynamic nature of it, because if somebody spins something up for a short space of time, destroys it, and then it's gone, somehow you've got to attribute that at the end of the month when you've got a charge for it. And it could be something that's done every day for a very short space of time. It could be something that's new that comes up and disappears. So there's a real dynamic aspect to what you're trying to do here. And I wonder how much of what you're trying to do is discovering things as it turns up and then trying to apply rules and logic. Because that seems to be that dynamic side would make things quite challenging.
And I think that's why I said tooling is so important here, right? This is a per second build world. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the infrastructure, particularly at companies that are cloud native and are using a lot of this stuff on demand as their requirements scale up and down on a second by second basis. You need software to do this after the fact. You need automation. You need rules. Otherwise, you know, you're back to the world of 2010 where someone's sitting there in a spreadsheet trying to reconcile all these things at the end of the month. Now, it's still giving you the data you need that's still within the best practices of FinOps that you're actually going and doing that. But I think it's far more manual effort and it's far more hassle than I think most companies want to deal with it if they want to operate in that dynamic cloud native model while still having those financial controls. So really having software, having something there to help streamline this really complex otherwise process, I think is critical, especially as architectures are evolving to be more dynamic.
Okay, let's dig down a bit deeper. So, you know, we've got an environment, large environment, all mapped out. We've got a fairly good idea of ownership. The next stage, I think I can see two scenarios here. There's one that just says, I just want to do cost optimization. You know, I might be able to look across the board and see resources that are partially utilized, underutilized, could be refactored onto, you know, whatever it happens to be, smaller VMs, smaller instances, really obvious stuff. But then there's another piece here that says, okay, once I've done that, there might be other things I could actually refactor onto a different platform. So it may well be that it, rather than running it as a virtual instance, I'd actually better off running it as a part of a Kubernetes cluster.
Yeah.
Or even, depending on how complicated modern software is to work this out, putting it into a serverless framework where actually that this could be something that's just responded to on demand. What are we seeing in the market in terms of those two scenarios? Is it more of the former or more of the latter that we're seeing?
So frankly, in the market right now, and again, I think it's very early days in the development of what FinOps really should look like, particularly in the cloud world, we are seeing the former. Most folks view, you know, post visibility, the cost optimization step as a one and done. You know, the pattern that we see, frankly, even with the visibility side, is people will have some visibility tooling or process in place, but they'll not really invest in it. And when costs go out of control or there's some compelling event like renegotiating a contract with Amazon, they'll go and look at it and do a one-time optimization. So you see these kind of spikes as people go look at it, pay attention for one quarter, and then ignore it for two quarters. And I think the issue that that creates is the fact that, you know, a lot of these one-time optimizations that you engage in and do for a week or two and then walk away from are really kind of suboptimal. I would say local optima, but not global optima. It's good at kind of looking backwards without a deep understanding of the roadmap from an engineering perspective, without a deep understanding of what the business growth and financial constraints are over time, to kind of go in and say, hey, this thing is just unreasonable waste. You know, there's a bunch of instances of EBS volumes that are just sitting there that are already backed up that we're paying for. And those are kind of obvious things that get cleaned up. But I think when you're talking about going further, what it really takes is moving from this, what I call this reactive world, where you're doing these one-time optimizations, bring in a consultant or something to go in and do this one-time set of changes and clean up for you, to one in which you're actually looking at your engineering roadmap, your forecasting, your planning scenarios, and understanding, hey, if I do move this workload to serverless, one, how long will this take? And then what's the price performance benefit? You know, right now, tooling like Archera is hoping to do that automatically for a lot of customers. And we have some ways to, you know, do things like modeling serverless migrations or modeling migrations from AWS to Azure, et cetera. But I think by and large, this is still being done in spreadsheets. It's still being done with a very bespoke sort of loop between engineers and their managers, where they run scripts, do little POCs, and see, all right, what is the leverage we can get out of this from a cost perspective, from a performance perspective? So it's still a very nascent space. And I don't think that scenario modeling, that forecasting is happening as effectively. And because of that, you don't get the ability to actually, you know, optimize over cost of capital over a long period of time, which is a very interesting financial constraint that comes into planning these. Or you don't get to think about how much flexibility you need for the different parts of your infrastructure over time, which could provide massive savings with very low engineering effort if you just have that confidence for different pieces of your infrastructure.
Yeah, so I just want to come and mention something to Martin here very quickly. And that's, when listening to this discussion, Martin, I do think back to what I was doing sort of 10 years ago, where we were trying to work out how to optimize, so more than 10 years ago, actually, probably, optimize the storage that was in use in certain environments. And the way we did it was we went and found the low-hanging fruit. So we built a set of criteria. We ran some scripts that identified that. But the funny thing was, and this is why I think it's quite interesting in this discussion, is that the execution of the recovery of that storage was typically based on the cost. So certain things were easy to recover, so we'd recover it because it was a simple case of just saying, release it with a command. Other stuff, we had to either move it, consolidate it, do other things, which took time and effort. And actually, when we looked at the cost, $1 per gigabyte cost of buying just some new storage and leaving that where it was cheaper than paying somebody to actually do the reclamation. So it seems to me that in this scenario, if we're not automating and we're not putting software in here to help us do this, we're not going to make the savings.
You're probably not going to make the savings. And as Aaron said, a lot of it is very one-off cost or a one-off side thing. I think it's interesting, actually, but a lot of the FinOps tools out there are really focused on almost taking what we used to know, then mapping them to the cloud. So there'll be a lot of work around instance optimization, potentially EBS, storage optimization. You're just moving good disciplines from your data center into the cloud. But the beauty of cloud is actually all the additional services. It's you can just look at the AWS services page, the hundreds of them. GCP, how in the future are we going to get a handle on those? Because they're not the same. They're different. It's understanding. And that's where potentially your bulk of your costs could easily go.
Yeah, that's it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because as soon as you start getting into something where you haven't got a real clarity of either the charging model versus your application, or an understanding of exactly how you'll be engaging with that. Like, you know, you always hear the story about serverless where people didn't realize how they were coding it and they were calling it a routine many times when they shouldn't have done. So it seems, Aaron, that you're going to have to go from what you're doing today and using other techniques. And I want to go back and just talk about your brother again. Yeah, that's because you briefly mentioned him in the introduction, and his background in terms of what he was doing. It seems to me like you're trying to say, well, let's take some of the advantage that the financial industry has used in the past and apply it as a technique into this model and this market.
That's exactly it. And if I was to sort of zoom back and just kind of reflect on what you guys are saying, which I think is very true, you know, on AWS alone, I think there's 13 plus different ways to run a specific containerized application. And for each one of those different ways, there is, I think, kind of on average, 30 different commitments or contracts or consumption models from a financial perspective that you can apply to those. So just understanding, you know, I have a very simple, say, WordPress container, how do I run it? You have to go through this combinatorial explosion of, you know, 36 cross 13 and evaluate each of those over time to understand, hey, what are the actual unit economics of this simple application? And what's unique about the cloud, and I think different from doing this optimization on premises, is after you understand, all right, how do I right size the application? Is there abject waste in this application stack, like a bunch of EBS volumes that are already backed up, piling up and needing to be shut down? You know, once you get past the low-hanging fruit, I think the big area for optimization comes from the actual pricing model. It comes from the fact that each one of those different commitment types or contract types that you could use to purchase the instances is essentially a, you know, we think of it as somewhere between a futures contract and, you know, like a power purchase agreement almost. It almost acts as a blend of those two types of financial instruments. And just by getting that piece right, by having high degrees of predictability and getting that right, you can move the needle by 30, 40, 50% in terms of the net spend on whatever that underlying application stack is. And that's really the world in which we saw the cloud having these unique benefits to customers over optimizing on-prem. You could basically make these optimizations without engineers, completely programmatically, and even better, unlike, you know, traditional capital expense, if you want to resell your Dell server, it's a massive rigmarole, you got to go unplug it. There's actually robust secondary markets for these contracts, for these commitments that most customers don't take advantage of. Only the large ones I've seen, you know, the Splunks, the Apples of the world will go in and take advantage of these because they have engineering resources to put on this that are dedicated. But these are very complex and intricate markets, and they've started to emerge just in the last few years for each one of these separate cloud vendors. So it creates this big opportunity to optimize in a way that I think, you know, no one's really done before, particularly in the IT space, but even in the cloud world. And it requires this understanding of really what is this from a financial instruments perspective. And I think that's why pulling my brother, my co-founder, in from D.E. Shaw, from the UberQuant finance team where he was working before, to think about this really allowed us to create a very innovative new model that I think going forward is going to be more and more the norm as you have more of these finance personas involved in the purchasing and decision-making flow for a company's cloud infrastructure.
So Martin, don't you think this is really interesting that we're going to move away from the idea of actually being concerned about the nuts and bolts, what our job was 30 years ago, and more this the financial side of it, the business side of it, the service side of it is becoming the main part, the key part of what we're actually doing. It's a very interesting transition.
It is. It's interesting. And I'm just wondering how people like ourselves, Chris, who've had 30 years worth of experience, how are we going to transition into this new world? These nuts where we're not worried so much about the nuts and bolts. It's always youngsters coming through who are going to have to learn how, some of the nuances of finance and pricing and it's like, we'll be fine, Chris, because we can retire in the next 10 years.
Well, yeah, that is true. I'm hoping it might even be less than 10 years. But I, to a certain degree, you know, I have sort of been involved in or at least looked at this in the past. I looked at something probably 15 years ago at JP Morgan, where we looked at pricing our storage supply, the capacity planning process, by a futures model, or rather I thought of doing that and I got laughed at for coming up with such a silly idea. But actually in reality, it seemed like quite a good idea because we had bulk purchases that would sometimes happen and then our line of business would say, oh yeah, we massively overestimated that. Sorry, we only need half of it. Or we need it next week, not 2 months time. Or no, we don't need it for another 3 months because this project got delayed. So inevitably in a large organization, that natural sort of ebb and flow could have made a lot of sense. And we're sort of hitting exactly that with this model, but having to, I guess, transition our skills at the same time.
Actually, the interesting thing, if you look at that, Chris, I mean, what cloud has done, what cloud does do, is it reduces the friction for that. So if somebody doesn't know, they can have it. They can have it immediately. But it also means it can actually bring some really bad behaviors as well, because you don't have to plan because it's just there. And so from a technical point of view, that's great. Finance will hate you and hate you forever because they want to know what you're going to spend in the next 12, 24 months. It's some of that. Whereas in the past, we had that friction. If that storage wasn't there, Chris, it wasn't there.
Yeah, that's
true. You weren't doing it, but now you could.
Yeah, that is very true. And I think this is an interesting point, Aaron, just thinking about this idea of the fact that we've now got futures, a effectively. We already have it. I mean, how long have we had spot instances, you know, long-term commit, all that sort of stuff. It sounds to me like the cloud guys were well onto the idea of this and working out how to do this long before we got to the point of realizing we needed to do it.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, again, if you look at the largest customers within AWS and Azure, they're constantly worried about actually running out of capacity. The infinite capacity hoax is essentially something that small companies can engage in. But when you get to any amount of scale in any of these vendors, you run into the fact there's only so many servers in the data center. And that fundamental understanding, which I think early on, because these cloud vendors were trying to build this market from day one, they were forced to understand. Their capacity planning teams, I remember when I was even at Azure, were running in the door and saying, hey, you can't schedule more VMs for this customer. We're going to run out for the rest of them. And pricing becomes one of the major levers to really help those teams plan and also allocate that capacity amongst these customers. So really, you know, I think what is old is new. Well, all they're doing is running a data center at the end of the day. And, you know, what is true within the JP Morgan data center for all of their business units is true within the Amazon data center or the Azure data center for all of their customers. And this is just the layer of abstraction, the mechanism that they're putting in place to help their customers navigate this. It obviously leads to a ton of complexity, but it's necessary complexity because it's reflecting the complexity of the supply chain fundamentally that is powering the underlying data center. So I think, you know, this is very much the same underlying physical data center. And at the end of the day, when you know, they want to come up with an allocation scheme, it goes back to markets, it goes back to pricing, and that's why these things exist. And I think spot and reserved pricing you're going to see over the next 3 to 5 years as these vendors become more and more competitive with each other. And I think hopefully the margins come down overall in the infrastructure as a service space. You're going to see a ton of innovation there as they start to understand that this is really the thing that's going to drive the dollars. Most cloud capacity is going to be, I think it already is in EC2, but in the limit across all services, I think is going to be committed capacity, is going to be consumed through these contracts and not purely on demand as folks understand more, you know, how the model actually works and what they're getting. They're not getting infinite compute for a set price. They're really getting a machine at the end of the day.
Yeah. Interestingly, I was going to ask you the question as to which areas that you see the most optimization being capable of, because we are a storage podcast. You'd think we would talk a little bit about storage, and we know that people consume masses of it, but I'm not sure whether that is necessarily the best area to do optimization in.
Well, it actually depends. I think there's a lot of optimization to be done in storage, right? If you look at just the delta between, say, Amazon Glacier and you know, infrequent access S3 versus frequent access S3, you can get a lot of leverage out of using a less available version of storage to reduce your costs. And we see that. But also, I think by and large, if you look at the database market where you have compute and storage kind of merged together in a way, that's where I've seen a lot of the compelling optimization opportunities, particularly with respect to selecting the right types of contracts and commitments for them. And then obviously in the compute market as well, where you have much more liquidity, much more volume, and a much more robust secondary market for these commitments, I've seen a ton of, you know, ability to actually go in and optimize using that secondary market and leveraging things like that. And something unique that we've pioneered there is we've actually, in the compute commitment market specifically, created an insurance product. So if you have something that you want to unload that you're not using, you can list it in those marketplaces. The liquidity, because it's, you know, very specific instance type, might not be there, and we guarantee the liquidity for our customers, kind of selling them essentially a liquidity insurance product. So I think there's a lot of ways, particularly in compute, that I've seen to drive a ton of savings with not a lot of engineering effort using these commitments. But I see that trickling down into databases and I think into storage as well. While AWS doesn't offer committed storage, at least not for small customers, you know, Azure does. And I think Google is going to soon. So you're going to see a lot more, I think, across all of the primitives. Data transfer, there's no commitments, but I'm sure there will be very soon. Across every one of those primitives, you're going to see more financialization, more contract types, because all these guys want is more certainty in their supply chain. They want to know how many boxes to put in the data center, how many lines of dark fiber to lay between their different locations. And this is the only mechanism they have to do that right now.
Mm. So Martin, this, you think back to when we would look at, say, buying stuff for your on-premises data center, we would have gone through a degree of financial jiggery pokery. We would, you know, we would have maybe worked on using lease or, you know, some sort of technique to be able to buy that technology back. This is a whole degree more complex, though.
But it's back in the day, we did have various financial models which were proposed by the vendors, you know, capacity on demand type models. They'd stick a storage array on the floor. You'd try and work out what you were going to use over 4 years, but you didn't pay for it all up front and either lease model or it came on. I think historically it's shown. I'm not quite sure how well it worked for people. We were always wrong and they were always wrong. But you're right, it's now getting to a stage where it is much more complicated. And then if you look at some of the cloud vendors, they offer different ways of committing. You've got reserved instances, you've got saving plans in AWS, you've individual bespoke contracts, which large companies are negotiating based on. It's a bit of a minefield. I mean, even for a fairly small company, you've got spot instances, you've got reserved instances, and even you can start negotiating saving plans, even if you're relatively small. And you've got the normal on-demand. Yeah. Trying to work your way through that. You have so many options for paying for the same thing.
Let's think about, you know, how it goes forward from here, because everything we've talked about so far seems to be fairly reactive, shall we say. And I mean that in the sense that it's tending to look at what's already provisioned and working out how we can optimize it or save it. We did talk a little bit about the idea of whether you could work out from an application the best place to deploy something, but there gets to a point where surely we need to start thinking about, when we're building a new application, recommendations that say, don't do it there, don't do that, don't do it this way. But that has to be based on things like good predictions of scale, good predictions of capacity and demand within the application from the business. And that might change on demand. So, you know, you might find that 1 week it peaks and then at other times it doesn't. So it seems that, you know, it's a never ending scenario within this, you know, whatever you do.
It is. It has to be continuous, right? And, you know, one of the core things that we're trying to drive into the market is the fact that after you do the visibility side, which we talked about earlier, and I think that's kind of a commodity, figuring out who's using what, you don't optimize. You actually have to go and build scenarios and forecast and project, and then figure out with those projections what you optimize. And those projections are constantly changing. As you get more data in, you know, something unique that we've actually done for customers is say, hey, you know, if this is the, you know, let's say you're a company that serves rides, like a scooter company that we work with, and this is the infrastructure that runs and keeps track of state for all of the scooter rides, and you can give me a projection over the next 2-3 months in terms of how many rides you're going to do, I can tell you where that infrastructure is going to scale over time and what the cost is. But every new day that we suck it in and actually compare the actuals to the projection then changes, right? So this is a dynamic thing. And, you know, even if I know that there's a migration going on or, you know, some other thing in the background and I have full information, there's still a lot of uncertainty here. So I think what we see from customers is, and, you know, this is customers of all levels of sophistication, is they generally undercommit, actually. They play it really safe. They commit to less flexible contracts like savings plans that only give you in the 20s to 30s percent savings rate versus 70 to 80% that you could get from a reserved instance that actually even has more flexibility if you resell it on the secondary market. So you see a lot of these suboptimal decisions come from the fact that there's just not a great set of best practices, set of tooling, set of folks who can even understand how to build these predictive models and use those to inform future purchasing decisions and make those financial trade-offs. And I think it's something that over the next 3-5+ years, that's going to have to become a competency for folks that are going all in cloud.
Yeah.
It has to become a competency, just like running your data center was a competency in the 90s and early 2000s.
Absolutely. And I think, Martin, the one thing that strikes me immediately is what you just said a few minutes ago, is that the type of person who's going to be good at doing this isn't necessarily going to be somebody who was in an architectural role previously where the environment was fairly static. You're talking about now a whole new set of skills to work out how to build an application and a suite of applications that can change dynamically as the infrastructure cost model changes.
Oh, yeah. And you end up with your own finance people or your own FinOps people who come from a financial or FinOps background. Their IT teams, architectural teams are looking to have. They'll have a FinOps architect embedded into the team to work with your existing technical architects to come up with financial models and optimizations based on that. It's become a much more interesting space. But you're right, we might see some interesting culture clashes, but it will be. And then you developers, and actually developers, of they need to be considering these things is actually how you give the developers some metrics, because they've got used to this idea that actually they don't optimize their code. But if that code is actually now costing money. And as you mentioned, the serverless examples where we've seen things run out of control, it's not optimized. You may find that with databases as well. People are going to have to take account of that because this is now real money.
Yeah. And I think, Aaron, that the work that has already been, I think, put in place, when it's certainly in AWS, they've got code analysis tools, haven't they, that can look at your code and optimize it. I don't know whether they optimize for cost or whether they just look at it and say this needs to be more efficient. But ultimately, there's going to be a cost angle to that code optimization at some point.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, Code Guru specifically, early days, I don't think they have a, you know, world in which they can give you sort of that net cost of a line of code yet.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, I think it's something that developers will have to pay attention to. But right now, actually, what I see is that there's just too much fatigue in terms of, you know, you have even tools within AWS like Compute Optimizer saying, go change these 12 different boxes from this to one of these three options, right? Or go buy this commitment type for this application stack. And there's just so many different little nuanced things that they have to go take into account that often you get alert fatigue and folks don't do anything. So I think more so than visibility into all those different lines of code, I think what engineers need, especially engineers in companies that care about innovating and driving top line instead of going and optimizing for the bottom line, you know, all day, every day, they need tooling or methodology that gives them a stack rank, give them the top three high impact things they can do that are low effort. And, you know, from the ratio of dollars saved to hours put in, are highest on that list. And I think it's really difficult right now to actually elucidate that from just the mess of different data and tools that engineers have access to just give them a clear plan of action, right? Even when we work with customers on building their forecasts and scenarios, part of that is saying, hey, what are the right sizing actions we should take this quarter? And what are the migrations, if we want to go from IaaS to serverless, et cetera, that we should take? And that becomes a really, really difficult problem because there's so many different things to consider. You either need a partner to kind of sit there full time and walk you through it, or you need that dedicated FinOps person who has not just the context from a financial and operational side, but really deep context on the application side to go and put those lists together for engineers. Otherwise, you know, they're just... I don't know if you've been in a company where PagerDuty is kind of put in place and then rings off the hook and no one looks at it anymore. But that's sort of the mode that we see a lot, particularly when it comes to cost, which is not a, you know, top two, top three item for most engineering teams.
I used to work in companies when you actually had a physical pager, when, you know, somebody actually gave you this thing you took home at the, you know, when you did your shift and you're like, oh my God, it's gone off again. As I'm sure you've done many times, Martin.
Yeah, you pretend you're a doctor though, don't you?
Yeah. Oh yes, it's really important. I need to get to a phone. Yeah, that was in the days before mobile phones as well sometimes, which is even worse. Okay, so Aaron, I want to finish on one small question, and that's make a little comparison to Google, to the search engines or even Facebook, and just take us back to the fact that, you know, we look at the way Google works. Every so often they change the algorithm. So you think you've done really well, you're gaming the algorithm, you're up the stack, you're on that first page, you're in the first two or three results, then boom, they change the algorithm and you're not anywhere to be seen. Yeah. I wonder whether once you've got yourself into a position where you're automating this and you're giving recommendations to customers, whether something will happen at the same end from the cloud providers and they'll look at it and go, hang on, we're losing money here because people are being too clever in their optimizations and they've changed their price structure. Do you think that's a risk? Do you think that's happening today? Or do you think that's something we should, you know, assume is not happening?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's interesting coming from working at both, you know, Azure and AWS and understanding some of the considerations, particularly around pricing there. I think the big difference from Google is the fact that the product, or Facebook for that matter, is the product in many ways is not trust here. There's a fundamental issue when you're manipulating Google search results and, you know, one of their core tenets is trust, right? So that's a breach of trust for their end customer if someone's coming in and manipulating this thing. Whereas with the pricing models here, you know, I know how a lot of these things are set. They're set by virtue of the competitive dynamics in the market. You know, what's the best alternative to going and buying this box with this specific contract, you know, sticking a GPU under your desk versus buying a 3-year commit from Amazon? Those should be roughly equivalent, right? And then how do we do this in a way that doesn't break our existing customers? That's actually a massive consideration for the cloud vendors. And so I think that in terms of pulling the rug, in terms of a pricing structure that they've put forward in front of customers versus maybe adding a new pricing structure that's more attractive along some certain dimension, they would always do the latter versus the former. Because, you know, one of the core tenets and the reasons that people even build on Amazon or Google or Azure is because they know their application is going to be there in N years because they're not going to break back compatibility. And two is the incentive structure is such that they want to be competitive in the market. So if they try and rejigger pricing retroactively for a lot of customers, maybe not introducing something, some new sort of pricing model that's more attractive, they would piss off a lot of people and they'd be less competitive. And they're already in a place where I think there's, especially around infrastructure as a service, there's a ton of competitors in the market, large, well-capitalized competitors. And if anything, that's going to move to a more competitive market, a more transparent market, one with more optionality for customers versus less as a function of that increased competition. So those are sort of my views there. But obviously, I could be wrong. Maybe, you know, Amazon has such strong stickiness that if they just say everyone's going to pay 3x, they're not going to lose any clients. But you know, I doubt that'll happen.
Yeah, I think, Martin, maybe it'll be tweaking things here and there, putting in extra tiers of storage rather than necessarily wholesale, just changing the model, I think.
I think so. I think you're going to see, you'll see new performance tiers at the high end and you'll see lower performance tiers at the lower end. And I actually thought Amazon did something really interesting at reInvent when they announced the new Glacier instant retrieval tier for storage. And if you were on Intelligent Access, that tier was put into you. And you can utilize it, and it's a big cost saving. There will be people who will be seeing 10, 30, 40% of their storage costs falling. Now, Amazon didn't have to do that. They could have actually said, you know what, you're going to have to go and enable it. But no, it's there. You'll have to go and turn it off if you think it's not right for you. So I think that's an example where Amazon may have done or have done the right thing for the customer. Hopefully the other, I'm assuming Google and Azure, we'll do the same thing. We'll see this. We'll see these cost benefits coming through. And certainly where you've got automation. And once you've got that, actually, and it's quite clever of Amazon, actually, because once you're using their automated tiering, you're probably going to be a bit more sticky.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's true. And that being said, you know, you still have more complexity being introduced as a function of this. So making those apples to apples between services, between different providers becomes harder and harder for the customer. So there is a trade-off, but I think we're going to see more complexity, even like with bandwidth. They're going to try and get you to send bytes, I'm sure, in the next 2-3 years when it's less congested versus more congested. You're going to get off-peak pricing and things like that. And what's going to happen is these contracts and this optionality is just going to reflect the data center cost, the supply chain cost, the operational cost of that data center closer and closer and closer over time.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Aaron, thank you very much for joining us. Would you just like to give people an idea where they can find your company, where they can find you, stalk you on social media, that sort of thing?
Yes.
If that's what they want to do. Because I'm sure a lot of people have listened to this and be really fascinated to dig deeper.
Yeah, very much so. So everyone can find me on Twitter at ArankhanNa, just at my name. And you can find our company, Archera.ai, at ArchERa.ai. And we actually offer kind of a free demo and free modeling tools. So if you want to actually go in and play with all these crazy pricing models that we're talking about and model out some stuff on your infrastructure, you can kind of come in, kick the tires and do that for free. You know, one of our big things is just trying to educate people on this FinOps space and the options out there and how they can start to navigate this complexity and build muscles in their organization around what we think is going to be a critical skill for the next 10 years.
Perfect. Aaron, thank you very much for your time. And I'm sure we'll come back to this again in the future. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Likewise, I really appreciate you having me on here and excited for the rest of the episodes in 2022.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.